station number 21613, Reel 4.
Could we talk a little bit about the Africa Corps? You mentioned that they were a good corps. Why exactly was that, do you think?
Well, I think that we had examples of where we've had wounded left out in no man's land, and the approaches at which we made under. We had one episode where Padre Gard, who was the Roman Catholic Padre with us at that time, he went out with a white flag to the German lines to arrange a truce so that we could bring these wounded in, and he got a very good reception from the Germans, and they agreed to allow us to come out and pick up the wounded. But unfortunately, on the way back, somehow or other, the news of what was happening didn't get to one part of the line, and there was a gun opened up, and that rather destroyed the whole situation. But fortunately, the Germans realised there must have been some mistake, and everything worked okay. And then we found that they were always very brave fighters, and what we knew, they'd treated prisoners well. And I think it was quite a bit of respect. And of course, we had a lot of respect for Rommel as a general, because he was a quite fantastic general.
Tell us about that. Why was it that you had this respect for the enemy?
Well, I think that, you know, troops, when they are in that sort of situation, they have not much else to think about except themselves and the enemy. And they very quickly get an idea what they're facing. You know, if people are facing a tough and fear, well, they respect them. If they're the other way, of course, you get quite a different outlook. But we always did respect the Africa Corps very much.
Known as the Desert Fox, Rommel?
Yes, he was known as the Desert Fox, and of course, Lord Haw-Haw called us the Rats at the Brook.
I was going to ask you, because you mentioned him being broadcast to.
Yes, oh yes.
How did it feel to have that being broadcast to you?
Oh, I think we used to think it was funny. And they used to drop leaflets, of course. They were always dropping leaflets, saying, to try and affect our morale, saying the Americans were getting off with the girls at home, all this sort of thing at the time. But that happened more perhaps later in the Alamein days rather than the Tobruk days.
One gets the impression that to what degree did the condition of fighting in the desert possibly affect how parties treated one another, how the enemy treated you, and how you treated them?
I really don't know, except that I suppose we both knew that we were both suffering the same appalling conditions. And I think perhaps that had some effect on it, you know, the way we thought. But I think that everybody was suffering, and everybody didn't know if the day was going to be their last. And I think you were just all in it together, whether you're enemy or otherwise.
You mentioned this also earlier on, that Rommel had been misguided in his knowledge of how strong you were. Yeah. Was that also the situation from the Allied point of view? Not realising how strong or weak the Germans were?
I don't know. But I think what happened when the Germans first hit Tobruk, the Royal Horse Artillery, they took their guns right forward, and they really, with the help we had what we used to call bush artillery, which were just reconstructed guns, and although they didn't have sights, and with the help of the Royal Horse Artillery and our own gunners, they really blasted the Germans early on, and I think Rommel mistook the strength. He thought there was much more strength there than there was.
You mentioned them earlier, and I was interested in discussing the situation that Rommel obviously didn't quite make it into more beyond the two perimeters that were out in front of the garrison. And that was, as I understand, largely that they just didn't have the manpower. Did you realise that at that time?
I think that what he didn't realise was that had they attacked when they first arrived, they'd have been through us and into the brook in absolutely no time. The great mistake made by the German High Command was not to attack in the early stages when they first arrived. They thought we were much stronger, so they set about consolidating, ready for an attack at a later date. But we were much more prepared when that time came.
You mentioned also earlier on about the skirmish war, the situation that you were facing. And you mentioned the patrols. Could you describe to us what it was like going out on patrol and being faced with a skirmish, a combat situation?
Oh, well, I think when you... what we used to do, of course, you've got no landmarks in the desert, and you just advance on certain number of paces. Odd, you might do 20 paces the first time, and you'll do 10, and then you do 15. You never do the same amount, of course, because the others may be lying in wait for you. And, of course, mostly what you did, when you got to the German post, when we did have actual attacking from these patrols, it was many times it was hand-to-hand fighting, and sometimes bayonet charges. But in most cases, we were successful in our patrol. They nearly all were successful patrols.
Were you involved in any of those hand-to-hand situations on a patrol?
I personally was never involved in a bayonet hand-to-hand skirmish, no. But others in my company and platoon were, yeah.
What stories did you hear of those situations?
Well, it was usually... the chaps came back, of course, often they'd lost some, they'd all brought back wounded, and really, I don't really know that I remember exactly what people were talking about. I think they're all... It was a funny situation, really. People didn't perhaps talk a lot about it. But you were sort of... You were living in a land of death, you know. You could smell death all the time, of course, because it wasn't possible to bury everybody, and out there were lying hours and there dead. And this, of course, contributed greatly to the problems of flies and the worry of dysentery. And I think it probably contributed a lot to the huge number of desert sores that everybody got. But we were a ragtag sort of a bunch because we didn't get changes of clothes or any of that sort of stuff. Actually, when you think of what precautions we now take against cancer, all of us spent most of the day just in shorts and no tops on, because the daytime was when you had to sleep, and or you were doing chores of one sort or another, digging in. But it's very hard to remember exactly what people used to talk about.
I'm constantly amazed that people can continue on in those circumstances.
Oh, well, I think there was no question at all. The whole of the Australian division that was in Tobruk were very, very confident. I don't think anybody ever thought that we were going to get beaten. Mm. And in the later part of our interview, I'll tell you when we heard that Tobruk had fallen, the reaction of many of the troops.
Okay. What is it like? You mentioned that you opened up on the advance guard when they first came to Tobruk. What's the response and feeling that you have when you know that someone's shooting back at you?
Oh, not too good. When it first happens, it's not the best. But the Germans, of course, very quickly withdrew in that first skirmish.
How do you sort of hold yourself together to do the job of fighting back?
Well, you really do it because you're all together. It's a combined thing. Everybody's supporting everybody. If you're in a good unit, everybody is supportive of everybody else, and you've got faith in the people that command you, and few in a command doing the job, well, you've got obligation to your troops, and I think it's faith in one another that pulls everyone through.
Is there a certain degree of bluff that a soldier has to maintain in order to keep his mates confident as well?
I suppose there is, really, and within yourself you probably do, yes. But I can say this quite honestly, I never in the whole of my time in the army ever saw anybody run from a fight or crack up. Never. Not one person did I ever see that happen to. And I think that spoke a lot for the division. They're a very fine mob of troops. Of course, we're all volunteers. And all those that went there were people who were really knew that they wanted to do something. They weren't being compelled to go, they weren't conscripts. So the Australian Army, at that, the ones out of Australia were all, as you know, volunteers.
Mm.
And this makes a big difference. And of course, we had some of the finest of our citizens amongst us. We had some very fine fellows who were leading us. And
you were a city chap, as I understand.
Yes. Yeah.
People talk of, you know, the difference between the country and the city boys out in a fight. Did you ever feel as though those from the country were better soldiers?
No, not at all. In fact, I would think that most of the commanding people came probably from the city. No, I never thought that at all. No, I think perhaps you did get stronger men, I suppose, who were farmers, but it doesn't necessarily mean they've got strength and courage or anything in that direction, or strength and ability. No.
What's it like then to have to realise that you're shooting someone and possibly going to kill them?
I don't think you even think about it. You get into that hype situation where it's kill or be killed, and you never think of it just doesn't worry you. It may at later time worry you, which after the war, some of the things that we've been through do come back to haunt you. But at the time they don't, I'm sure. Yeah. Well, certainly didn't with me.
What is there that suddenly you're in an extreme stress situation, like in a combat situation? How is it possible to go from, as you say, boredom to this extreme situation?
Well, something heats up your blood and you get into a sort of it's hard to explain if you've ever been in that situation. But you almost get a feeling of that you're invincible. And you get the whole body gets hyped up. And it's an extraordinary experience, but you'll only experience it when you've been in that sort of a situation. And you don't think you're going to get killed. You just think you're going to kill the other bloke and finish it off. Yeah. If you did think you were going to get killed, of course, I suppose your morale would be affected.
People that I've spoken to talk of the split decision timing that you have,
mm,
and the importance of that. Was that something that you experienced?
Oh, yes. Yes, timing is so terribly important. In fact, a lot of our of the tragedies which we had in the desert, through as units and otherwise, were because of timing mess-ups. Timing was absolutely imperative to the minute, and everything just had to work to time. If your tanks didn't come on time, or the unit didn't get to the position you were supposed to get to on time, which happened to us, it was a disaster. Everything had to coordinate.
To what extent does the individual have to sort of work on autopilot in a situation like that? I get the impression that if you have time to think, that's when you're most likely to get yourself into trouble.
Yes, oh yes. You just think of what's ahead and you go, you haven't got time to think about any of the nasties. You really just think about the job on hand. if you're sitting, lying in a trench, waiting for something to happen, then maybe you'll think of what's ahead and the nasties that may be going to happen, but not in the actual, at the time, you just, if something happens where you just do it. It's very hard to explain.
People talk also of the sixth sense, or that sort of feeling that the soldier develops. Can that be explained in what you're saying?
I don't know, really. I don't know, really, if how you would explain that, but I suppose training gives you a bit of an insight to that. And I suppose in those sort of situations, you do get a bit of a sixth sense. I don't know.
What then of, you know, the final release, you know, after the battle? How does one sort of wind down?
Well, it's usually a state of complete exhaustion. And you just, once it's over, and you just, that's the time when you try to get sleep or relaxation or whatever. Talk about it to your friends. There's not a lot of, there's a lot of boredom in the army, but it depends just what situation you're in, whether the boredom's there or not. Because a lot of the time you're not actually fighting, you're there in case you're attacked or you have to attack. But in that, all of that time, you have to fill in. And when you have no reading matter, the only reading matter I had was the New Testament.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
And I tell you, boredom is a very difficult thing, particularly when you're lying.
Talk of chain smoking?
Never smoked. I never smoked because I saw what it did to those around us who couldn't get cigarettes. And that was the one thing you'd see. Fellows would be desperate for a cigarette. And of course, we didn't get great supplies of cigarettes, as you can imagine. And unless I never smoked, which I'm very glad about. But when you're lying in a slit trench or down in these black cement positions, which we have, this old Italian, there's nothing really. It's too dark to read, so you just try and grab a bit of sleep. With the rats running over you.
The rats running over the rats.
Running over us. The rats, yes. Yeah, the fleas. Yeah. But, now, I think a lot of this sort of situation is boredom. You've got a lot of that.
What of losing comrades in battle?
Oh, yes. Well, that's pretty sad.
Was that something that you experienced often?
Oh, yes, quite often, yeah. Yes, our first, one of the first casualties in Tobruk in our battalion was our platoon commander, Lieutenant McGregor. He was a great big chap, always laughing, and he went out with my, on a patrol with my brother and others in the patrol, and he got blown up with a mine very early in the stay at home. He was a married chap with two young children at home. His wife, I haven't contacted, but I know where she is. She now lives in the eastern states, has never married again. And she must have brought up those two children alone. Well, that's, when you look back, those are the sad things. But at the time, sort of death was something you just faced up to, and somebody was killed, well, it was really bad, but you couldn't dwell on that too long.
What did it do to the rest of the platoon to know that the commander had gone?
Oh, everybody was pretty sad, but then somebody had to take over, do the job. So the sergeant, of course, did that until such time as they replaced him with a new lieutenant. But you get very used. See, we'd been all through our training with McGregor, and that's a big hole when that somebody like that goes.
What of other mates?
Oh, yes. Yes, sad. But
I've spoken to people that you can't really afford to get too close to
No. Well, later on, when I got my commission, I found the hardest part really writing back to their families of chaps that were killed. That's the nasty part. But as a, in the ranks, well, you haven't got that worry, that responsibility, and you just go on.
To what degree is your faith strengthened in being a soldier, do you think?
Well, it's a funny thing. I used to read this New Testament through, as I've told you. And I used, funnily enough, I got tremendous strength out of that. And it's something really that only lasted during the war. But I did at that time get an enormous amount of strength out of that, out of the New Testament. It's something very hard to explain. And I think it probably helped him, help you to carry on. And what few letters we got from home, they also helped.
But was there ever a time when you really thought, what is the point of all of this? What, you know, when you've got comrades being shot, off to battle, in the heat, the situation you're in, was there any time when you felt this is just a, you know, futile, no, ridiculous situation?
Not really, no. No, I don't think, well, I certainly didn't. I think because before the war, and up right up until to the ranks of the start of the war, I had parents who were very worried about the situation and realised the evil that was coming. And I think that sort of conditioned me a bit to realising that there was something, a job that just had to be done. And the defeat of Germany was, there's no doubt about it, the loss of the Second World War would have been far more disastrous than the loss of the first one. It would have been disaster for the world. You know, it was really fighting evil. As a regime, we were really fighting evil, there's no question. Whereas in the First World War, slightly different situation.
Mm. You mentioned earlier on that you were fighting, you know, a good, well-respected corps.
Mm.
Do you think that it was down to the individual general, into the individual soldier, as to how they behaved? Or do you think that the Germans were this sort of evil horde?
Well, I think, you see, a lot of them don't think were. I think a lot of German people shut their eyes. Well, they had to shut their eyes to it. I mean, if you were living in a regime where if you stepped out of line, they did terrible things to your family, people thought twice about it. But I think the Afrika Korps were mainly, they came mainly from the Wehrmacht. They probably had their political officers there, of course, they would have had them. But the main, they didn't come from the SS or anything like that. There was a different army altogether. And a lot of the nasty things that were done back in Germany and by the SS and people like that, and the type of people that you got into concentration camps, and because I think most of our prisoners in the prisoner of war camps were treated pretty well. The Australians and British prisoners were, on the whole, from what I'm told by those that were prisoners.
What's the sort of philosophy that the soldier then develops in a frontline situation like the one you were in?
Well,
you talked about faith, you talked about sort of split timing.
Yeah.
But at any moment you might get hit by the bullet. Yes. Right here.
Well, I think I don't know really. I think you probably hope it won't happen to you, and I don't think you dwell too much on that, because if you did, that would be disastrous. You think you're never, like a lot of young people, you think nothing's ever going to happen to you. That's what I did anyhow.
You you also mentioned earlier on that you went into Tobruk on the odd occasion to unload the ships. Could you give us an idea of what that situation was like?
Well, as I said, the destroyers used to come in at night, and they come on a very strict schedule because, of course, the Tobruk Harbour was bombed mercilessly. And I always remember going down once with my platoon to unload a ship, and we were having an awful lot of trouble getting a gun barrel off of the ship. And all of a sudden, from up on the bridge, we heard this very English voice, officer, call up, "Can't you great big Aussies get that itsy bitsy gun barrel off?" And you can imagine the result from the troops. But we had a tremendous respect for the Navy, of course. They were wonderful. Wonderful in every way. With our wounded going out and the way they came in. Because it was very difficult navigation. Everything in the dark. No lights to guide anybody. But it was just, you just went in there and unloaded the ship as quickly as you could, and they were off. And then when the ship was unloaded, you went back to the unit.
The importance of the Navy, obviously, was to sort of help those people in the garrison.
Yes. Well, of course, they were our lifeline. They brought our food in, and they brought everything in. Because they had to be quick ships that could move at speed, so they... And the destroyers, of course, and they all had speed. So, whereas an ordinary merchant ship, well, they didn't bring many of that. I think most of the merchant ships that were there were always sunk. I don't think any merchant ships came in. But they got pretty well all supplies came in by the Navy. As far as I know, they did.
Mm. Could you describe the place to us?
Well, as I remember it, it was a... The buildings in Tobruk were quite nice because it had been an Italian outpost, but of course a lot of them had been bombed and knocked about. But it was an unpleasant place, and the harbour had a lot of sunken ships in it, of course. But I never actually got into the town in daylight to see a lot of it, but it. It was probably quite a comfortable place in the days when the Italians had it as a post.
When you came in, what was the process of being brought in from the front line?
Oh, well, you came in on... You were taken in the dark in trucks. You trucked in. Yes. So you went back sufficiently from the lines to get the... See, the trucks didn't really come forward much at all, of course, because they were very, very limited in the number of trucks they had. And a truck was an extremely valuable piece of property, so you just marched back until you got a rendezvous with the trucks and they took you in. But no, getting food up to the line it was absolutely imperative to have trucks, and the loss of one was a very bad thing indeed. But it's amazing what they could do. It was incredible what Phyllis could do to put a truck together and get it going again. You wouldn't believe what was done at different times.
I get the impression that there was quite a lot of mixing and matching from
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And actually, the Phyllis that had our, what they used to call the bush artillery, they became very accurate. In time, and of course the Royal Horse Artillery helped them a bit. They gave them hints and with the sighting and that sort of thing, because they didn't have sights in any case.